This particular installment is simply titled On the Road To. Well, the story goes that there were two Canadians who died and they went to hell. And Satan put them in their own cell and he turns up the heat to 49 degrees centigrade, figuring that was a good temperature to start off the newcomers. He comes back after a while and finds the Canadian shirtless and smiling. They say to the Satan, "We love it here. It never gets this warm in Canada. So we're enjoying it while it lasts." And Satan gets outraged by this, that the two Canadians aren't miserable at all. Angrily, he turns the heat up to 60 degrees centigrade, figuring nobody could enjoy that. Lo and behold, he returns to their cell and sees that a bunch of Canadians have turned up into a group and are having a cookout. Furiously, Satan decides to try a different tactic. He turns the thermostat all the way down to minus 20 degrees centigrade, and all of hell freezes over. And Kathleen Satan visits the cell and finds the Canadians having a roaring party. "How can you be happy?" he demands. "Well, it's obvious, isn't it? They said hell has frozen over, so the Leafs must have won the cup." Sorry for all the Leaf fans up there. You know, hell is one of those topics that really draws a line in the sand for a lot of believers. Some take the traditional view of a lake of fire and weeping and gnashing of teeth, something like Dante's Inferno, if you're familiar with that. Others see hell as kind of metaphorical, that without God in our lives, we're damned to an eternity of isolation from His grace. And then, of course, there are believers out there who just don't think it exists at all. Well, I'm not going to speak for you today, but clearly, Job's friend Bildad, as he begins his second speech, believes in hell. His sermon actually is very well crafted with some very excellent theological points. But Bildad misses the mark in applying his sermon to Job's situation. Therefore, it becomes a sermon that does not edify us, and it certainly doesn't edify Job. Job has just spoken to his friends about his house or his bed, and he wonders where he will reside after he dies. That's what Job said. Well, Bildad, I don't know how you do, claims to know exactly where Job is headed. He's going to hell for the things he said he believed. Bildad's sermon really has two parts to it. The first part talks about how the world works. We've heard some of this before. There's a moral stability in the universe and everyone has their own place in it. Therefore, the wicked have a place we call hell. Bildad accuses Job of just playing word games. He calls Job to come to his senses and see his error. "Are you calling us cattle?" Bildad said. "Do you think we are stupid? Job, you are doing all of this terrible stuff to yourself. You are inflicting even more hardship on yourself than you need to." Once again, Bildad underscores the three friends' viewpoint that Job is outright wrong in denying that his suffering is undeserved. Bildad goes on to say that God can no longer bless a sinner than move a mountain on a whim. That's kind of interesting, isn't it, considering what Jesus said? Ironically, Job has already said God, this is true about God, way back in chapter 9. And Bildad's use of place indicates that these three friends dwell in a well-ordered universe where everything makes sense and everything goes where it's supposed to. They think Job would say, as we often do, "I'm not in a good place right now." Bildad invites Job to see where wicked people dwell and then draw his own conclusions. Hell, Bildad says, is a place of utter darkness There's no light for a deceased wicked person. Picture a room with no external illumination at all. You kind of get the idea. Hell is a place of inescapable punishment to Bildad's mind. Hell is like a trap, a mesh to ensnare the wicked. Job has lost everything because he's caught in this trap. He has been snared by his own misdeeds, Bildad says. Bildad may be picking up on the fact that Job describes his own, he describes himself as a situation where he is trapped. God has hunted him down, Job says. Hell then becomes a place of insatiable terror. The word terror here invokes our sense of demonic, doesn't it? This is what Sheol, the place of the dead which these men believed in, was like for the wicked. It is like the black riders in Lord of the Rings pursuing and embodying evil. Calamity awaits the wicked to step into that snare. The firstborn of death mentioned here probably refers to death itself as the orchestrator of this great terror. Again, an image from our own culture could probably help us. When we think of death, what do we think of? We usually think of the Grim Reaper, don't we? That guy that comes with the hood and the scythe to get people who are unprepared or unaware. Hell is also a place, Bill, that says of total destruction. It's a complete loss of yourself. His imagery here is very vivid, isn't it? Fire resides in his tent, refers to that sulfur and brimstone we've heard about over the years. A wicked person's tent or habitation is utterly destroyed, Bildad said. Nothing of what identifies us as an individual will be left. Even our branches, our roots, meaning our descendants and our ancestors, will be wiped out. Jesus uses that same imagery, believe it or not, in Luke 17, when he recalls the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, he says, so will it be that they, on the day when the Son of Man is revealed. In Mark 9, Jesus says, hell will be the place where the fires are unquenched. Then Bildad says that hell is a terrible place of separation. The wicked will be separated from a world of life and light. The wicked are like a blot on God's creation, and they will be removed to another place. The name of the wicked will be erased from the world. Psalm 9 verse 5 says, God will blot out the name of the wicked. Now, Bildad's point is pretty unnerving, isn't it? Imagine a person dies and there's no record, no memory of them ever being alive. Hell then is a place with no stability, no center, no known location in the entire universe. It will have no record of people or events. It is in essence outside of reality. A person ends up in hell by their own hand, says, Bildad's implication then is that Job is already experiencing this. He's already experiencing hell. Job is already cut off from everything that identifies him, and also from the blessings of God. We use the same kind of thought and expression we use all the time. Job is experiencing hell on earth. And it is where Job is heading for eternity, Bildad said. These are not comforting words. They're awful. But you can see from this passage how the church got some of its concepts of a place called hell. Bildad's words have considerable merit. They cause us to think about a lot of things, particularly that his idea that the world or the universe has a perceived order to it. It was God who brought creation out of chaos. Bildad Hildad's portrait of hell is pretty close to the traditional view that is preached probably today by hundreds and believed by many good Christians. God will one day come and he will judge the living and the dead. In Matthew 25 is the parable of the sheep and the goats that kind of refers to this. However, and this is important, Bildad drops the ball in one of his most important premises. Yes, the wicked go to hell, but Job is not wicked. He is described at the very beginning of the book as blameless and upright. A blameless and upright believer is experiencing the torments of hell. And in Bildad's system of the universe, there is no place for that. The reality is that some wicked people in this world do prosper. And some blameless believers suffer enormously from undeserved grief. Job's experience, once again, points to Jesus. I've been saying that all along. Who experienced hell while he was on the cross. When he died, all the world was cast into darkness. Jesus felt dragged down into the inescapable punishment for the wicked. His relationship with the Father was cut off. We've talked about that. Jesus suffered a public humiliation. I hope you're beginning to see that you really can't understand the book of Job without the cross of Jesus. You and I are called on to endure by faith the struggles of a road to hell until we receive our full redemption and new bodies from Christ. That's in Romans 8:23. We are all called to drink of a cup, drink the cup that Jesus drank. That being said, Job responds in chapter 19 by revealing the tension in Bildad's words. If God is in control of the universe, why is there so much evidence that he isn't? Consider his situation. Job is still wanting to know from his three friends and God himself, is God for me or against me? If God is for me, then nothing can ultimately do me eternal harm. But if he's against me, all hope is lost. The very ancient question abounds through the book of Job. But here, in this chapter, it just shouts at the top of his voice, why? Why did my spouse die? Why did my spouse get Alzheimer's? Why is my grandchild sick? Why do I suffer such enduring headaches and I find no comfort or peace? In other words, given our perspective from Job, we wonder what was going on in heaven to make this happen to me. I know the Bible says that God loves me, that he's in my corner, but it sure doesn't feel like that right now when I'm in a terrible place. You know, the pat answers we learn in Sunday school or read on the sympathy cards, they kind of fall flat. Bildad may be accurate in his description of what happens to wicked people, but he fails to apply it correctly to his friend Job. Job admits in verses 1 and 12 that God is kind of treating him like an enemy, isn't he? His three friends have simply rubbed him raw with their insensitivity and their arrogant theology. In fact, their treatment of Job is worse than the bankruptcy and the loss of his children. You know, Job has never once claimed that he was sinless. Not once. But he does claim that he's blameless. That in his religious devotion and sacrifices, he has done right by God. God even declared him at the very beginning of the book as being blameless. While his three friends and Job agree that God is the author of his woes, they disagree as to the reason why. Job goes on to describe his experiences as if God had sort of mugged him in the street. God should help me and defend me, yet he assaults me, Job says. There's no justice here, he says. The dominant image in Job's speech is once again the idea of a city that is under siege. Like a king that is under siege, he's been stripped of his glory. All of God's troops have set up siege ramps on all sides. And Job is in his tent, an image of weakness and vulnerability. What threat am I to God? Job keeps insisting. It would be like all of us camping in a local park of delight, being surrounded by the entire Canadian forces, with their guns and their tanks, etc. Not only is he under siege, but Job acknowledges again how terribly isolated he is, how incredibly lonely he is. Have you noticed all along that not even his own wife is there beside him? All those he had relied on for fellowship, for community strength, have abandoned him. This is what Bildad said happens when you go to hell. Job used to be the lord of his domain. Now his associates treat him like he's a dead man. That he's a social pariah. Job is literally too repulsive to be around. Little children of the village, they mock him. They throw rotten fruit at him. Job knows intimately what it's like to be attacked as a sinner. The problem all through the book is that everyone assumes Job deserves this. Job diagnoses his condition as the hand of God is touching me. The intention here is not positive. God is clearly against me, Job says. One detail, however, that Job does not know is that it was the Satan who had touched him, not God. But God gave permission for it to happen. So Satan is thrilled with this line of thinking that Job is going down. He likes nothing better than for Job to attribute his calamity to God's direct action. You see, Job and his friends, they don't have a place in their theology for an agent of evil. Job doesn't know what to do about that. Job, though, is beginning to wonder who is the agent of his suffering. Job explores more fully what he needs in this experience is a mediator. He also says, O earth, cover my blood. In other words, like Abel's death in Genesis, may Job's innocence not be forgotten. Job continues to cling to the hope that he will be vindicated, that he will be proven as being right before God. In his struggle to prove his innocence and that he does not deserve this torment, but he fears he is losing the battle. Even in death, he fears he will not find his vindication. His headstone should read something like this. Here lies Job, who was a sinner with secret sins. He refused to confess. He's taken the penalty of his sins at last, and the justice of God has been vindicated by his death. May he not rest in peace. That would be a big headstone. His friend's words say he's an unrepentant sinner. Job's words say that he feels unfairly punished. It is a war of words over Job's soul. How Job longs to have his memory and his struggle preserved. And then Job leaps to an inescapable conclusion. Job knows he needs a redeemer. The word redeemer is an important one throughout the scriptures. Job states he has a living redeemer. someone who is tied to him in a covenant. A redeemer was someone who avenged your death, or if your wife was widowed, you made sure, or if the wife was widowed, you made sure she had a child. The story of Ruth and Naomi is a beautiful story, how the redeemer system worked. But Job's redeemer is eternal and therefore must be God himself. The Old Testament has several examples of God being Israel's redeemer. Some people find it hard to imagine God helping Job against himself. That's what Job's talking about here. The concept of a redeemer before God really is difficult to grasp until we remember Jesus. Job also says that his redeemer will stand upon the dust for the earth. It may be that the redeemer is standing on his grave, vindicating him even in death. Job is also sure that one day he will be face to face with his Redeemer God. Unlike Bildad's picture of what will happen to him, Job has faith that he will be escorted before God to see him. To stand before God means to have a right relationship with God. At the very end of Psalm 17, David writes, "As for me, I will be vindicated, and we'll see your face." Job is bold now in his faith. He's changed a little bit. "I know," he declares, "I shall see for myself." Job says he faints inside himself for the anticipation of finally seeing God. Literally, the word heart here is bowels. Because in ancient times, they believed that's where the seat of emotions were. What a glorious insight Job has. There is a sovereign Redeemer who lives, and nothing can separate us from the love of our Redeemer, as Paul writes in Romans 8. How do we know this? Well, there once was a man who was viciously assaulted by the terrors of hell, who did not deserve what he experienced. A man of great faith who bore all things to be our living Redeemer. I can face tomorrow because he lived. Job ends his speech with a warning to his three friends. And maybe a warning to all of us. His friends pursue him because they still hold on to the idea that Job's suffering is because of his sin. They cannot believe that Job's suffering can be innocent or even redemptive. There's no place in their well-ordered worldview for the idea of undeserved suffering and undeserved grace. Therefore, they themselves stand under judgment. They are in great danger of speaking against God's plan for Job and for themselves as well. These friends, if nothing else, need to accept that sometimes suffering is undeserved. We may rail against God for allowing it to happen, but in the end it still happens. If you feel sometimes that God is against you, that God is this terrible monster trying to destroy you, we may feel lonely and that no one cares, we need to hear Job's words in these moments of our life. Chapter 19, verses 25 and 27, engrave them on your hearts, says, "I know that my Redeemer lives, and at last will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, whom my eyes shall behold, and not another. Heart faints within me." May we all have faith that is so great that our hearts faint within.